The 4th Annual Woodstock Comedy Festival returns to the Bearsville Theater with some of the biggest names in comedy this coming weekend. Susie Essman has played Susie Green for all 8 seasons of HBO's critically acclaimed and award-winning Curb Your Enthusiasm. Her hilarious bouts of withering sarcasm and insults that her characters make are a trademark of the show. Now you can see her host a hilarious night of stand-up comedians at the 4th Annual Woodstock Comedy Festival on Friday night at 8 p.m. in an event called Laughing Stock. It's always a thrill to welcome Susie Essman to the roundtable. How are you?
I'm good. And it's also a benefit.
Yes.
Which is the most important, which is why I'm doing it.
That's very, you do a lot of that. That's very nice of you.
I do. One of the greatest parts about what my job or my success in my world is that I could use my celebrity, so to speak, to raise money for things that I care about.
That's great.
It's a great thing.
So when it comes to doing something like this, when it's a showcase and you're working with other comedians, mm-hmm. is that something that you enjoy, of seeing what other people are doing?
I'm taking a little break from stand-up, so that's why I'm hosting. I'm not headlining. Because I've been doing other things, writing and just other places in my head. And this is all women comedians. I don't know 2 of them, so I'm really excited to see them and see what they do. And the other 2 I haven't seen in a really long time. So I get to be really the audience.
Is it fun to see, because obviously you have great history in this, of what it is like for, in some cases, of what we'll be seeing on Friday night, women who are just starting out on this voyage, of what it's like for them compared to what you went through.
Yeah, I mean, I started 33 years ago, and I think it's changed a lot. There were only a handful of women at the time. When I was growing up, my role models were few and far between. I mean, I had Joan, I had Phyllis, I had Toadie. And that was about it. And my dear departed friend, Ann Mira, who was part of a sketch. She wasn't doing stand-up. But right. I think the women coming up now have, like, including myself, have, like, massive numbers of role models, which is great.
Well, I know when Joan Rivers passed, we had you on, and we talked about her. Phyllis Diller, do you think she gets often overlooked for her place in history?
Yes, and Phyllis was amazingly funny. And you know, Phyllis had a very interesting life. She didn't start till she was in her 40s. She didn't start stand-up till she was in her 40s. She had, I don't know, I think 5 kids or something. Yeah. She had raised all these children. And I believe it was Bob Hope that took her under his wing and had her opening for him. The thing that always strikes me about Phyllis is Phyllis was a beautiful, funny woman. And at the time, in order to be accepted as a female comedian, remember, she had that crazy hair and the crazy outfits and the cigarette holder and the, you know. And it was almost as though she couldn't just go out and be this beautiful, talented woman that she was in and of herself. She had to have a costume and play a character to be accepted as a female who was funny at that time.
She was a great character. She created a character of Fang, who was her husband.
But wasn't really her husband
and had this whole thing going. But she was also allowed to be herself and to put herself into these various situations through these characters.
And she was very, very supportive of, I met her so many years ago, maybe 30-something years ago. She couldn't have been lovelier and more supportive. Mm. She was a wonderful person.
So,
and by the way, in her old age, when she retired, she became a painter.
Yes.
And an excellent painter. She was massively talented and brilliant.
I saw one of her last shows at the Mohegan Sun, and it was billed as one of her last shows. And it was short. She came out. She was quite elderly. But my God, the timing was still perfect.
Yeah.
And it was just a delight to see her because she was amazing. Really, really amazing woman. I also just saw one of her costumes at the Smithsonian. So I hope some of that's changing.
Yeah. Oh, okay, cool.
That's good stuff. All right. So do you feel, having been in the business and doing this for 3 decades or so, that you, I don't know if obligation is the word, but a responsibility to perhaps guide some of the other
younger
comedians?
Yes, I do. And I like taking young comedians under my wing. And I like watching them and helping them and giving them advice. a great pleasure, as I've been told by many what an influence I've been on them. And it's a great thing.
Yeah, it's very nice. Okay, so the big news, yeah. Season 9,
yeah.
Curb Your Enthusiasm. It, what is it? How many years? Seven?
Six.
6 years?
Well, it's 6 years since we shot, yeah.
So you're coming back.
We're coming back. We start in November. We start filming in November.
Now, what is that like to get the phone call from, I assume, from Larry David?
I did get, you know, I'm sneaky. I've been hawking Larry for 5 years already. When are we coming back? And he's like, leave me alone, leave me alone. And then I don't know. Larry and I are very, you know, Larry and I have like a dialogue of the unconscious going on. We have like a telepathy, and I just had a feeling that he was thinking about it because I knew where he was at. He did the play. He did a movie. He was supposed to do another movie that he was just acting in, but I had a feeling that was falling through. So I texted him something about the Yankees. You know, we talk about sports a lot, but it was really a ploy. You know, so I just texted some nonsense about Starlin Castro or some whatever. And he texted back and said, I'm seriously thinking about doing season 9, which was just, I didn't even respond. I didn't want to push it. I didn't want to jinx it. And then a couple of weeks later, he called me and told me we're doing it.
I know some people in the cast were saying, well, I assume I'm in it. But you knew, right? You know you're
no.
in it. Really?
No. I mean, my husband would say I'm crazy. But, you know, for every season, first of all, I didn't have a contract anymore. My contract expired, obviously, after 6 years. Yeah. You know, they're not holding me. Every season, I never knew that I was going to be back, and I never knew how many episodes I was going to be in. So I have my mole, which is Larry's assistant, Laura, who I've been very close friends with since, you know, we started. So I would always, you know, email Laura and like, are they talking about me in the writer's room? She's like, don't worry about it.
You're fine.
Don't worry about it. But no, I never felt secure. I didn't feel secure until a couple of weeks ago when HBO got in touch with my manager and, you know, presented the deal for all 10 episodes. I never know how many I'm going to be in. It's Larry. He's so mercurial. You just never know with him. So he could decide, for example, that all of a sudden his character is going to Africa and shooting, you know, 10 episodes there about, and it's about him, but it's not. It's the family's back.
Okay. So you know you'll be in all 10 episodes?
I don't know I'll be in all 10 episodes. I know that I will be paid for all 10 episodes. That's all I know at this point. I haven't seen any outlines. I haven't heard any storylines. But I know that my contract is for all 10 episodes.
So is it divided? Is there any division in your mind between this? Because it seems as though, well, obviously, it's great to have a paying gig and a job and to go back into a very successful franchise.
Right.
But it also seems, in talking to you and having talked to you in the past about this show, that there's also just the great glee of going and doing it.
Oh, this is the greatest job I could ever dream of. But they're on so many levels, Joe. First of all, I did text Larry maybe a month ago, when could I see the outlines? And they're not ready yet. So as soon as they're ready, I'll see them. And then I'll be even more thrilled because every time I read the outlines and I see what he has in store for me, I mean, it's just, you know, whether it's, you know, riding in a car with him having an orgasm or the things that I read, I'm like, I can't believe he has me doing these things. First of all, there are so many comedians that I know who are great comedians who are working and happy to be working, but they're on shows that they would never watch.
Right.
So I'm on a show that I consider one of the greatest comedies in the history of television.
Absolutely.
That I get to improvise the entire thing, that I never have to memorize lines, that, you know, at this point, because I'm on for season 9, I'm very well compensated because there's a history. I wasn't for many years, but I am now, so there's history. It's just, we have so much fun when we're shooting. I can't think of a better job. I feel incredibly lucky, incredibly grateful that we're coming back and that I have this job.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is there a family atmosphere there in the sense that because you've been together for so long?
And also so many of the crew members are coming back.
Right.
A lot of these crew guys have been there since season 1. Season 1 I think we did in 2000. So we're talking about 16 years ago. And a lot of these guys are coming back. And, you know, when you're working on a show like that, you're working sometimes 15, 18 hours a day. You know, you have breakfast, lunch, dinner together. You're together all the time. So, yes, there's a tremendous sense of family. And there's a couple of people that aren't coming back that I'm devastated about.
Are you allowed to tell us who?
Oh, you, crew people. Dale Stern, who's our right. AD, who's now AD and directing on Veep. Christina Mangini, who's my wardrobe what's more important than Susie Green's crazy wardrobe?
That's right.
She's on Silicon Valley. You know, over the years, other people have had to get other jobs.
They've had to go work, sure.
So, you know, there's a number of people that aren't coming back because they're working, which is nice for them, but I'll miss them.
Was it weird when somebody like Cheryl Hines, who is on the show, and then that character is divorced, and then you sort of don't know of how they're going to fit into the puzzle anymore?
Yeah, I don't know if Cheryl's back on the show. I mean, as I said, I haven't heard storylines or seen outlines. I would venture to say she's not a regular.
Yeah.
Maybe she'll come back in an episode or two, you know, as Larry's ex, but I doubt that she's a regular.
So does it ever...
Larry has told me, by the way, that if he's divorced in real life, he doesn't want to be married on television. Go figure that one. But yeah, I get it, you know.
I guess
he's enjoying his life as a single man. He doesn't want to then be married on television.
But this would keep me up at night if I were you, of saying, oh God, what if he divorces me and Jeff?
And Jeff, well, we have been already. We've separated already.
Yes.
I think more than once. But you know what? I'm guaranteed 10 episodes.
There you go. So you really don't care at this point. Is it... So talk about that outline process. Once you get the outlines, and it's improv. So how does that unfold to get what we ultimately see? And well, I guess I'm ultimately asking the question of when you have it and there's an understanding, is that sort of a group think? Oh, okay, that's really good.
Well, it's interesting because Larry writes the outlines with Jeff Schaefer at this point and some other people that he works with that he bounces things around. But ultimately, it's him. Most actors are not allowed to see the outlines. He lets me see them for some reason, always has. Jeff, of course, sees them also because Jeff's one of the executive producers.
Right.
I don't think Richard Lewis sees an outline. None of the guest stars see an outline. Because what he doesn't want is he doesn't want people coming with a preconceived notion and writing bad sitcom lines in their head that they're trying to get out. So when a guest star shows up, they're just told what the scene is about. And what the outlines are about 6-7 pages. There's about a paragraph saying what happens in each scene in terms of story.
Mm.
There's no dialogue written unless there's a piece of dialogue that's essential to get out for story purposes. So it's all about the story. And if you watch it, Larry's genius is story. I mean, there's so many callbacks and so many things woven in and out of an episode that are story dense. So that's what the outline is. The outline is just what has to be accomplished in each scene.
I think of the season as maybe the best example of this when Larry is doing the producers.
Right.
But that particular season was brilliant, as they all are. But to your point, that beginning, a middle, and an end over the 10 episodes to have that kind of story is you don't see that anywhere. It's just, it's beautiful. And yet, each episode in and of itself is perfect.
Well, and each episode usually has two storylines.
Right.
I believe, and I'm not sure about this, other people who are fans would know better than I believe that two storyline thing started with Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Larry and Jerry really created that interwoven two storyline format, but I'm not sure about that.
When you do something like that, let's take that season.
And then, by the way, speaking to what you were saying about the producers, every season has an arc.
Right.
First couple didn't, but since then, every season has had an arc.
Some sort of issue that has to be resolved.
Right, right. And usually two.
When it, let's say...
Like producer's season was the producer's arc and the anniversary, Larry and Cheryl anniversary arc was woven through that.
Which was the question as to whether he could cheat on his on his anniversary. Now, you look at the end of that, you've got, and I'm thinking this is a scrapbook question, meaning you look back on your career, you look back at the moments of this incredible show, but Mel Brooks and Bancroft, I mean, that has to just be a sweet memory.
Well, for me especially, because Mel was my first, when I was 5 years old, was my first comedic influence. There have been times, you know, one of the nice things in my career is that I've been able to meet some of my idols.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't want to meet your idols.
Oh,
sometimes
yes.
You're really, really disappointed
yes.
when you meet your idols. Mel was not disappointing whatsoever. Yeah. He was warm. He was funny. He was, you know, I remember that we were having lunch on set and we were out in a parking lot somewhere and he took his shirt off. You know, and there he is, like, getting a tan while we're sitting outside. He's like some old Jew in Miami Beach with his shirt off, having his lunch in the parking lot. It was just, it was thrilling to me because when I was, I guess 1960, I was 5 years old. And my parents got the 2,000-Year-Old Man album with Carl, who I've also met and, is, yeah. and was not disappointed
Carl
either. With Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks. And I used to listen, at 5 years old, I used to listen to that album over and over again. And in retrospect, I couldn't have gotten the jokes. They were way too sophisticated for me at five. But I got the rhythm and the timing. And I knew things were funny because of the timing and the rhythm. And I used to stand on the kitchen table in our house, and I would do the entire album, both sides, Carl and Mel. You know, this little curly-haired five-year-old standing on the kitchen table in Mount Vernon, New York. And it was that rhythm was so deeply ingrained in my comedic brain that sometimes even now when I'm on stage, I hear their rhythm in my head. So to have met both of those, the two of them, and to have them have been so supportive and wonderful and great human beings and funny was a great thrill for me.
And I've had wonderful conversations with Carl Reiner about this, but the idea that he is essential to that. I mean, Mel Brooks,
oh,
of course, goes
and of course it's all improvised.
But it's all improvised.
Yeah.
But he is the straight man, but still brilliantly funny.
The timing, his timing is brilliant.
Yes, it's amazing.
Yeah. I still listen to that album, by the way. And anybody who wants to be a comic should get that album, the original 2,000-Year-Old Man album, and listen to it.
Are there other essential albums, you think?
Well, you know, that one to me is the most. But in terms of studying, listen to Nichols and May.
Yeah.
Their timing is just also, the timing from the old Nichols and May albums are just mind-boggling. And also improvised. I listen to a lot of Lenny Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there's anybody. Bob Newhart, fantastic, his early albums.
Button Down Mine.
Yeah, just brilliant, brilliant stuff.
And those comedians, when they say of what was going around them, they were listening to Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, different people that became.
Well, Pryor, I never listened to his albums, but Pryor, I saw his concert films, which was a huge influence on me. Pryor. And so many comedians will tell you this. There's two different schools. There's the Carlin School and there's the Pryor School. And so many, Pryor to me was the greatest comic ever.
What's the difference between the two schools?
Carlin, who was also a brilliant comedian, Carlin was more cerebral. And Pryor was more rip his guts out. You know, he was more just, he's an open wound for all to see. Both brilliantly funny, but just from a different kind of coming from a different head. You know, Carlin was all about language and very intellectual. And his stuff was all written. You know, Pryor was just, Pryor did everything. I mean, Pryor did jokes, characters, accents, storytelling. He was incredibly accessible and vulnerable. He turned himself in. It was so personal, his stuff. In a way that Carlin was a little more separated, a little more distant from his own personal feelings, I think, in his own life. Whereas Pryor he was just out there with it and brilliantly funny.
We just had a remembrance of Gene Wilder, who had done the show several years ago, and we talked a lot about Richard Pryor, and he told a story about Silver Streak where the Gene Wilder character is going in. He's trying to pretend to be black, and he's putting on shoe polish, and to try to get out of the situation. And Richard Pryor didn't want to do the scene, and he was very upset about the scene. And it was finally Gene Wilder who cracked through and said, well, why, what's wrong with the scene? And he said, because you have a white person coming in and seeing you, Gene Wilder, doing this, and it should be a black person who comes in and sees and says, this is how you have, this is how you properly be an African-American in this particular situation. And Gene Wilder's point was that he was able to dissect something to the nth degree.
To get to the brilliance of Pryor, and not to take anything away from George Carlin, but Pryor was also an actor, a movie star.
Yeah.
He was also a great film. He was a writer on Blazing Saddles.
Yes.
That's how he and Gene first met, that he was, you know, he was a screenwriter. I mean, the man was just, and especially given his background, and, you know, it's just, he was mind-boggling, the level of talent that he had. There are people in the world who are gifted in a way beyond all others. He was one of them.
Are you confident as a comedian that we have people that rise to that? You're in this festival with Gilbert Gottfried. I mean, are there people that rise to that level?
Of a Pryor?
Of a great comedian.
Yes, of a great comedian. Pryor, to me, was a completely other level.
Sure, yeah.
Gilbert is one of my... Gilbert can make me laugh more than anybody in the entire world because he appeals to, like, you know, the fourth grader in me. You know, he's so silly and so... Gilbert's so interesting because Gilbert... And I've known Gilbert for 33 years or something. Gilbert knows exactly where the funny in something is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gilbert's a great impressionist, but he's not an accurate impressionist. Gilbert's impression is he just gets that one little thing that's so telling about the person and is able to just, you know, go along those lines. He knows where the funny is just instinctively.
He was on Friday and he did a Paul Wynn impression, and it's basically... It sounds like Gilbert.
Right.
But it also sounds like Paul Lynn.
But he found that one little thing in Paul Lynn that makes it so funny. Yeah.
So other people who rise to that level of great comedian, do you think now?
Oh, geez. You're putting me on
the
spot.
No, I'm sorry.
I will say this. You know, having been in this business, and the word genius is bandied about quite a bit. But Pryor was a genius. There are very few. But Larry David, I believe...
Yes.
Fits that category. And I know, not as a stand-up, but as a comedic creator, as a comedic writer, when I get those outlines and I read them, and I have a comedian's brain, I can't figure out how he got there. So there's a transcendence to him. So when you're watching somebody like a Gilbert even, there's a transcendent quality that you can't figure out how they're getting to where they're getting. That, to me, is genius.
So let me ask you a question about, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but somebody like Amy Schumer.
Right.
Can you tell now, or does longevity have to come in?
Longevity has to come in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, right now,
she's very hot. She's very hot.
But what will be happening in 10, 20 years?
Correct.
Yeah. And that really makes
And she's a good comic.
Yes.
She's a good comic. Is she a great comic? I don't know yet.
Jury's out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that can, with that said, were there people 20, 30 years ago when you were in the clubs and you look at them and you see them walk on stage and you say, oh, all right. Well, they clearly.
Well, for example, Jon Stewart.
Yeah.
Jon and I started together. And you could just see this kid, you know, genius, I don't know, but this kid had something. You could just, his material was so original. Chris Rock and I started together. And I'll say this. In the very beginning, I didn't see it in Chrissy. You know, I mean, we were both just struggling. We were both, you know, and I thought he needed work. I didn't think he was a bad comic. I thought he needed work. And then he reached a point where I was like, okay, he found his voice. You know, the hardest thing for a stand-up comic is to find their voice. And it takes many, many years, 10, 15 years sometimes, before you really figure out who you are on stage. Just, I mean, not that Chris wasn't funny. He was always funny. But I remember when he found his voice and he then moved on to the next place.
Did doing this show help you find your voice?
No.
You had found it.
I had found it by that time. And my Susie Green character is a very different voice than my stand-up voice.
Yes.
You know, Susie Green is an acting job. I was at a store in Hudson the other day buying something. And the woman's like, you look familiar. And, you know, I hate to say you've seen me on TV because then you feel like an idiot. You know what I mean? What if they have it? You know? So anyway, she finally figured out who I was. And she said to me... you know, I just never would have thought it was you because you're so civil. Well, it's called acting. I'm not that character.
Right.
I'm acting.
And on stage, but it is acting on stage too.
On stage is a heightened version of myself. Is a stage version of myself. My stage persona is much more who I am, but it's the stage persona of who I am. So, I mean, it's not interesting for me to be on stage. I'm having this conversation with you right now. We're sitting in a booth. There are comedians that would be here right now and be on.
Right.
That's not me. When yeah. When I hit the stage, I'm on. When I'm off stage, I'm off stage.
And, I mean, Carlin used to say that the greatest hour and a half of his life was that hour that he was on, you know, that
right.
when he was on that stage.
I don't feel that way. A lot of comedians feel that way. I don't feel that way.
Yeah. Well, you're going to be hosting Laughing Stock.
Not that it's a bad thing when I'm on stage. It's just not, it's just a lot of people, that's their oxygen. You know,
right.
That's where they're the most alive is when they're on stage. I enjoy life.
Well, it seems like that means there's more of an evolution of a human being, right?
Correct.
There are other things
Correct.
That you enjoy
yeah.
than just what you
yeah,
do for
I mean,
a living.
I'm going to go home now and I'm going to pick my tomatoes and my basil and my garden and make a fresh caprese salad. I can't tell you the joy that brings me.
That's a good thing. It's beautiful. Well, after the salad, you're going to be at Laughing Stock. It happens this Friday, the 23rd. At the Bearsville Theater as part of the 4th Annual Woodstock Comedy Festival. As you mentioned, this is a benefit for the Polaris Society.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about what they
Polaris
do and why
Society.
It's important.
Well, I mean, they are on the forefront of human trafficking. I can't imagine anything more horrible than losing your freedom, although for some reason people in this country seem to be willing to give it up pretty easily at this point, but including their First Amendment rights. But yeah, human trafficking is something that goes on in this country, and it's prevalent in a way that people kind of want to shut their eyes to. It's a horrifying, horrifying thing, and this organization does great work all across the world in dealing with human trafficking, which is mostly, I don't know the numbers, but it's a primarily female issue.
Sure. So this
is people are slaves. People are bought and sold into slavery now in 2016.
In this country.
In this country and all over the world. And it's right. got to stop.
The event is a benefit. It's part of the 4th Annual Woodstock Comedy Festival. It all happens this coming weekend. Your stint is Friday night at 8 o'clock. It's entitled Laughing Stock. And some wonderful comedians
yeah.
will be with you. And you'll be hosting. It's Friday the 23rd at the Bearsville Theater. Part of the 4th Annual Woodstock Comedy Festival, woodstockcomedyfestival.org. Susie Essman, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you very much for
Thank
being
you,
with
Joe.
Us.
Thank you, Joe. Always like to see you.
And right back to you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.